When I say that McDonald's hot coffee lawsuit, you say what? In the new documentary, Hot Coffee, filmmaker Susan Saldoff asks people what they remember about that 1994 lawsuit.
The woman, she purchased the coffee and she spilled it on herself. I mean, it wasn't like the McDonald's employee took the coffee, threw it on her.
It's just people just are greedy and want money and they'll do anything to get it.
How did they form those opinions? Well, filmmaker Saldoff goes on to remind us that after 79-year-old Stella Liebeck was burned by her spilled coffee and received a jury award in a trial, it was then reduced by a judge. She eventually settled for far less because she'd become a national joke, fodder for late-night comedians.
Every minute they waste on this frivolous lawsuit, they're not able to waste on other frivolous lawsuits. Like, ooh, my coffee was too hot. It's coffee!
But what if people knew how hot McDonald's coffee was, or that the company had over 700 complaints? And what if they saw the picture that the jury saw, from her buttocks to her knees, her entire pelvis, including her genital area, ugly, bubbling blisters, completely incapacitating Stella? Well, now you can see that picture. The film Hot Coffee revisits that case, but also makes the claim that it became part of a campaign led by big business and political consultant Karl Rove to undermine individuals' ability to have a jury of their peers settle a lawsuit. And filmmaker and former attorney Susan Saldoff, we'll speak of her critics in a moment, joins us from the NPR New York studios. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
To the Hot Coffee case first. Let's do that. As we said, you asked people what they remembered about it. Then you showed them those pictures the jury saw. Help us describe, Susan, these injuries.
You know, she had third-degree burns over 16% of her body. The coffee in question was so hot that it caused third-degree burns within 3 to 7 seconds. She went to an emergency room, and the emergency room doctor called a burn specialist. And the burn specialist said, "Why are you calling me? It's a cup of coffee." And the doctor said, "No, you don't understand. This is like one of the worst burns I've ever seen."
Well, and how did jurors make their decision about her financial settlement?
Well, they wanted to punish McDonald's because McDonald's knew that their coffee was so hot. The quality assurance specialist who testified said that he knew that no one could drink coffee at that temperature. It would cause burns. And the jury got so angry at the callousness of McDonald's. And the award was 2 days of coffee profits for McDonald's, which was $2.7 million.
I think one of your jury members says, "We didn't think it was even that big."
Right. And just as an aside, Mrs. Liebeck, all she wanted was the difference between what her medical bills were and what Medicare paid. And McDonald's never offered more than $800 at any time.
So suddenly, Stella Liebeck becomes the poster child for bad jury decisions.
Everybody mocked her. And you have to understand that at the time that this verdict was rendered, which was in August of 1994, you have to know what was happening politically in our country. Bill Clinton was president, and the Congress flipped Republican in November of 1994, and Newt Gingrich became the first Republican Speaker of the House in 40 years, and he had his contract with America. And one of the contract points was tort reform, or putting limits on people's ability to access the court system. What he knew and what big business knew was that if we could limit people's ability to get into the courthouse, then large corporations would not be able to be held accountable. And so there was this public relations campaign, millions of dollars that was spent to convince us as an American public that our court system is broken, that there are too many frivolous lawsuits, jackpot justice. These were market-tested terms, focus-grouped to get into people's minds, because when people would believe that our system was broken, they'd be willing to reform it. You know, reform, everybody thinks, is a good word. You know, it's used in every political campaign now. And tort reform became sort of the mantra.
Well, as we said, there are critics of this line of thinking who say, wait a second, we really do need to have some sort of reform. Look at medical expenses. And we're going to get to that in a second. But there seems to be a lot of evidence that there was a campaign for tort reform, no matter what the thinking might have been. Karl Rove, who worked for Philip Morris, pushed tort reform. But as you note in the film, the Republican Congress failed to pass this legislation. Bill Clinton vetoed it. So this campaign then turned to the states. How so?
In most of our states now, we have caps on damages, which most people don't really care about or think about until it affects you personally, which is sort of the truth about almost everything. You know, it's always somebody else's case that's frivolous. It's never yours. But in most states now, even as we speak, there are measures to put more limits on average people's ability to get into the court system.
Well, let's stay with caps, because this brings us to your Exhibit 2, the case of Colin Gurley of Nebraska. His mother was pregnant with twins but wasn't sent for an ultrasound. As a result, one of the twins was born with severe physical and mental injuries. The jury awarded the family $5.6 million. That was the estimated cost of care for this severely damaged young man. But the state had put a cap on damages, so they were eventually awarded only $1.25 million. In the film, the father explains what the effect of this is.
And so Colin, you know, ends up with a few hundred thousand dollars. And so what happens is then he goes on the Medicaid, and the taxpayers have to pick up the bill for his care.
The problem with caps on damages is that legislators who never get to meet the person who's being injured or hear the case, they come up with an arbitrary number. And they say, all cases, this is the absolute maximum that this person is ever going to receive. And what happens is that the wrongdoer isn't held accountable. It's the public that has to pay. Our tax dollars are paid for the difference between what the cap is, potentially, and what this person's medical bills or needs are for the rest of their life, when in fact a jury has already ruled that the defendant or the corporation or the doctor or whoever it is at fault, and that this amount of money should cover this person's expenses.
You say this campaign has another front. In state courts, you bring us to the case of Oliver Diaz. You say millions of dollars was spent by phony grassroots groups to unseat this Mississippi judge.
What it was is that he was a judge who sometimes would vote in favor of a consumer and against large corporate interests. And what happened was is that large corporate interests didn't want people like that on the court, particularly the state Supreme Courts, because when jurors render verdicts that are for consumers, most of the time, large corporate interests appeal those to the state Supreme Courts. And in many cases, these state Supreme Courts are overturning jury verdicts. Many times, these judges are literally handpicked by large corporate interests and money funneled into their campaigns so that they would be elected and judges who are more pro-consumer are defeated. And John Grisham wrote a whole book about this called The Appeal, which he fictionalized the story that's true that we documented in our film regarding Mississippi State Supreme Court Justice Oliver Diaz.
And Diaz wins despite all the money being poured into his candidate's coffers. But then he's prosecuted on criminal finance charges his supporters say are trumped up. He's cleared of all those charges, but since he's taken off the bench so long to fight them, he just can't win a second run at re-election. I mean, he's very clear that he feels he was completely targeted and hit by this campaign.
Yeah, and he wasn't the only one. As you may recall, when Alberto Gonzalez was our U.S. Attorney General, there was a whole scandal around the fact that there were U.S. attorneys that were being fired around the country because they weren't bringing cases against some of the largest Democratic contributors in various states. So Oliver Diaz was caught up in the middle of that, as were many other politicians and judges.
Lawyer Susan Saladoff, who took her strong views about tort reform and turned them into the documentary Hot Coffee, airing on HBO Monday night. Essentially, she makes the claim that there's been a campaign funded by corporations and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, run by people like Karl Rove when he worked for the Philip Morris Company, to undermine an individual's ability to sue in court and receive a jury award. A campaign that includes state caps on awards, replacing judges sympathetic to awards with judges who aren't, and finally, a campaign to get lawsuits out of jury trials and into mandatory arbitration, kind of a trial without a jury of peers. That brings us to the case of Jamie Lee Jones in 2004 and 5. I think she worked for the contractor KBR in Iraq. Susan Saladoff, tell us about Jamie Lee Jones.
When she was hired at the age of 19, she lived in Houston, she signed an employment contract. And in the employment contract, embedded in the small print, was what's called a mandatory arbitration clause. What these clauses say is that if you ever wind up having a dispute with this company that you're signing this contract with, the company picks the decision maker, pays for the decision maker. The decision maker doesn't have to give a reason why he or she comes up with the decision. It's completely secretive and there's no right to appeal. Jamie signed one of these, not having any choice as an employee of Halliburton. She was given a promotion to go to Iraq. She was promised that she would live in a small trailer with another woman. She gets there and she's put in a dorm with 400 men. On the fourth day that she's there, she's drugged and gang raped by co-employees. And because there's no criminal liability when you're a contractor in a foreign country, there was no criminal liability held against these people. She tried to sue them in the court system, in the civil system. And because of the mandatory arbitration clause, she's been denied access to the court system up until just this past week. Right. There was a bill that Senator Al Franken put as an amendment to a defense appropriations bill to prevent companies from having these types of mandatory arbitration clauses in employment contracts for contractors with the U.S. And as a result of that bill, Jamie was able to go to court, and she's in the middle of trial right this minute in Houston, Texas.
Let's get some pushback, Susan. Let's go back to the McDonald's hot coffee case. As you well know, there are people, and you hear from them in the film, who think that this boils, and no pun intended, boils down to being a consumer issue. On the blog Abnormal Use, which is an unreasonably dangerous products liability blog, it's run by a law firm, Gallivan, White & Boyd, that defends products. They talk about the Stella Liebeck spilled coffee case. They add another one, a Cynthia Gamro, who ordered a cup of coffee at a Chick-fil-A drive-thru in St. Petersburg, Florida, also spilled her coffee, also claimed burns and sued. They say no one's disputing the severity of Ms. Liebeck or Ms. Gamro's burns. We do, however, question the need for attributing liability for those burns to the producer or seller of the coffee. They say this is consumer-driven. People love piping hot coffee. They say there's no evidence that either woman expressed concern before the accident. They probably liked it. They probably, like most Americans, wanted it piping hot. Isn't hot coffee not dangerous until it is negligently spilled by the consumer?
Mrs. Liebeck was, in fact, held accountable for spilling the coffee on herself. She was found 20% at fault by the jury. But the jury found McDonald's 80% at fault because of the long history that they had of knowing that their coffee was so hot that it would burn on contact, and how many times they had paid out other people for burns.
Well, Susan, what about the people who might believe, as you do, that there has been a concerted campaign for tort reform that's really a campaign to get rid of jury awards? But they still believe that some sort of reform is needed. We hear from doctors all the time who say they can't afford to cut back, let's say, on tests, even if they know they're unnecessary, because patients demand them and they don't want to, you know, be victims of lawsuits. And we know of cases of fraud. There was the Massachusetts firefighter who claimed a disability, but then, oh, look at that. He turns out he's a bodybuilder, and there's pictures of him in a bodybuilding contest. These are not jury trials. But does it go to the point that big business makes that people, given the opportunity, will cheat?
Look, there are always people who are going to try to take advantage of a system. But the truth is that there are so many more legitimate cases of people who try to bring these cases and are met with obstacle after obstacle after obstacle. They can never get justice, even though something serious has happened to them.
What about the claim by people who back reform that reform passes on savings to the consumers? In states, for instance, where there are caps.
That is absolutely not true. The insurance companies wind up making more money, but they never pass on the savings to the healthcare providers or to the insured. And in Texas, for example, where they've limited people's ability to access the court system in medical malpractice cases since, I think, 2003, the health cost of healthcare has gone up, not down.
You mentioned that people are all for tort reform until suddenly they're the ones who end up in court. What do you say to people who say, well, I would never be, oh, like Jamie Lee, who signed a contract with an employer saying that she couldn't sue? I would never do something that stupid. Are we maybe already signing those contracts?
We are signing those contracts, and most of the time we don't even have a choice. I mean, you can't get a cell phone right now and activate it without agreeing to mandatory arbitration. You can't get a credit card right now without agreeing to mandatory arbitration just by using your credit card. Not only employment contracts, but our car loan contracts, our mortgage contracts, our health club contracts, they all have these clauses embedded in them. Many times it's in the small print, and who cares? Nobody's even thinking about it when they're signing these contracts because nobody thinks they're ever going to have a dispute. It's only after they do have the dispute, then they go back and the people say, oh, no, you can't go into the court system system. You have to go into this arbitration system where we pick the arbitrator and we pay for the arbitrator. And people say, wait a second, I thought I lived in a democracy. But literally, we're handing over our rights. Right now in both the Senate and in the House of Representatives, there are bills pending. It's called the Arbitration Fairness Act. Senator Franken has introduced it in the Senate, and Congressman Bruce Braley, who's in the film, has introduced it in the House. It's really the only way that we're going to be able to get these clauses out of these contracts.
Susan Saladoff, a lawyer and now filmmaker. Her documentary is Hot Coffee. It'll be airing on HBO. Check your listings. Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, Robin.